Hi, Dave Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 841, interview number 4 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy. This is being recorded on March 29th of the year 2015. Once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter Lavenda, the author of, among other titles, The Hitler Legacy, which is the focal point of our ongoing discussion. Peter, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Many thanks for having me.
And people, the most common question I get over the decades, I've gotten over the decades, is, well, I believe what you're saying, but I don't know what to do about it. What can I do about it? At the end of the program, Peter will tell people where they can get this very important book, because reading that book and communicating that information is something doable, so to speak, that people can do. Now, at the end of our last interview, we were recapping the World War I German origins, courtesy of Max von Oppenheim, of global jihadism, and then we were carrying that forward into the period between the wars and the war itself. If you would encapsulate the von Oppenheim stratagem and then bring that into the context of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini.
Certainly. To recap what we discussed before, Max von Oppenheim, of course, was an amateur archaeologist. In an age of amateur archaeology, I suppose. He lived in North Africa. He lived most famously in Egypt. He lived not far from Al-Azhar University, which is actually where Haji Amin al-Husseini attended university. Von Oppenheim believed himself to be an expert on things Arab and on things Islamic. And when the Great Game began in that part of the world, when there was a lot of intrigue concerning the British, the French, the Russians in the Middle East, the Balkans, and access to the Suez Canal, and it looked as though the Kaiser was going to go to war, von Oppenheim advised the Kaiser to enlist the aid of the Ottoman Turks and to enlist it on a religious basis to convince the Sultan that it would be best to declare a jihad of all Muslims around the world to rise up against their colonial masters, meaning specifically in this case the British, the French, and the Russians. This was the first ever global jihad. Now, when I say global jihad, I mean the first ever jihad of the entire world, of all the Muslim populations around the world, to attack the enemies, quote-unquote, of Islam, which were very carefully defined to exclude the Germans, by the way, even though the Germans did have colonies in Africa, which composed many Muslim populations. But be that as it may, the idea was a strategic one, to enable the Turks to enlist the aid of the Muslims living in North Africa and the Middle East to rise up against the British, French, and Russians. This was Max von Oppenheim's idea. The Sultan embraced it, and he declared the jihad, and it did not really work. Many Muslims who belonged to the Bedouin tribes in what is now Saudi Arabia and across the Middle East and parts of North Africa did not heed the call. They despised the Turks. They despised Turkish rule, Ottoman rule, and they rose up instead against the Turks, aided and abetted by the very enemies of the Turks, the British, the French, and to some extent the Russians, but mostly the British and the French. The British were extremely involved in this operation, of course, as we know. T.E. Lawrence, the famous Lawrence of Arabia, was enlisting the aid of the Hashemite royal house, which was the royal house in charge of Mecca and Medina, the holy places of Islam. He got their support against the Turks. And there was another famous chieftain called Ibn Saud, and Saud was also being paid off by the British to fight against the Turks. Remember, there was a lot of money involved. There were weapons deals. There were all sorts of other considerations. This was not strictly a religious war of any, by any means. The Arabs were not revolting against the Turks on religious grounds. This was strictly a political situation. And even then, it was very hard to get all of the Arab tribes together in concert to fight against the Turks. This was not easy to do. And people had to be paid off constantly. This is something that's good to keep in mind when we look at the present-day situation. But as we all know, World War I ended with the defeat of the Germans, with the defeat of the Ottomans. There was the famous Versailles Conference and the Treaty of Versailles, which decimated Germany, which carved it into pieces, which took away its industrial capacity, which made it incapable of raising an army and declaring war again. So there was this fracturing of the German Empire of the Kaiser. And at the same time, of course, the Middle East. The Middle East sphere of influence was carved up between the British and the French. The Arabs, who had assisted in overthrowing the Ottoman Turks, were basically not consulted. as to how the boundaries of their countries would look after the war. They were not consulted about Israel, which was another big bone of contention. The Balfour Declaration, which created the State of Israel, basically, which was the promise to give the Jewish people a homeland in Palestine, was not something that was signed on to by the Arab leaders, if they even knew about it. And in many cases, the Arab people themselves felt betrayed once again. They felt that they had been betrayed, first of all, by the Turks, and now they had been excessively betrayed by the Western foreign powers, the Christian foreign powers, we might add. So now I'm a Jewish Christian, of course, because of the Zionist aspect. So suddenly, Saudi Arabia is created out of whole cloth because Ibn Saud was the British, the primary candidate for ruling that part of the world. Ibn Saud was a Wahhabi. He was a member of a fanatic, you might say right-wing fanatic Islamic sect, which is what we're dealing with today in many cases. Instead of putting Prince Faisal on the throne, which would have been legitimate, as Faisal was the Hashemite ruler of Mecca and Medina, he was considered too moderate. He was not a Wahhabi or a Salafi. We put Saud in place. We made some deals. When I say we, I mean the British and the French, mostly the British, made deals concerning oil wells and the access to the Suez Canal and all of this. And the Middle East, of course, the part that we know today as Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, was all carved up by the British and the French and the Sykes-Picot Treaty, among other things. And in the end, when the dust had settled, the Arabs were no better off than they had been before. The Arab person on the street is thinking to themselves, you know, there was this war that was fought, and we lost, and the Germans lost, and the colonial powers have won once again. And not only that, but guess what? There's going to be a Jewish homeland in Palestine, right in the heart of one of the holiest places of Islam and Christianity. The whole thing looked like it was rigged, like it was some kind of a global Jewish, Christian, European conspiracy, just the way that they had been talking about it during World War I. And out of this mess, out of these contradictory treaties that have been signed, out of all of these agreements that had been made and broken with reckless abandon, arises the Emir al-Husseini. Al-Husseini was a member of a prestigious family in Jerusalem. His brother was mayor of Jerusalem. He was a student at Al-Azhar University in Cairo. He had fought with the Turks during World War I and then had allied himself with Prince Faisal. But then Faisal lost his position. He wound up being king of Iraq, which is very funny since Faisal really didn't have much in the way of ties to Iraq. And al-Husseini became disgusted with the entire thing, became disgusted with the British and the French, became disgusted with the betrayals that were all around him, and decided that he would become the spokesperson for an uprising against the British in Palestine. Jerusalem, of course, is in Palestine. He was from a famous Palestinian family, family based in Jerusalem. So he decides that what he's going to do is instigate a rebellion. He became, in short order, the figurehead for a rebellion of Palestinian Arabs against the British powers. He became a very vocal opponent of Great Britain and of course, of the establishment of the State of Israel. And a series of riots ensued. They became known as the Arab riots or the Palestinian riots. It took place in the 1920s and the 1930s. Al-Husseini was at the forefront of all of this. And he became the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And that's a title for a religious leader who is the ultimate religious leader in a given geographical area, in this case, Jerusalem. So through a series of negotiations and intrigues and backroom deals, al-Husseini, who did not have a degree in Islamic theology, by the way, then became the Grand Mufti. And his activity was less religious than it was political. His entire raison d'etre was to get rid of the colonials from Palestine, particularly the British. So as this is happening, as this is growing in power, and as now the nascent Jewish population is also growing, and the intrigues are starting, and the fights, the street fights and the riots between Jews and Arabs are taking place in Palestine in the areas under the British mandate, because the British are still in control of that part of the world, the British themselves are stepping back from it for the large part. They don't really support the idea of an independent Jewish state. as much as the Balfour Declaration had promised it, the local British military commanders and the British population in general was more sympathetic to the Arabs than they were to the Jews. So this became a very three-way, four-way fight in that part of the world, and the alliances and allegiances kept shifting. But one thing was certain, amongst a bit all of it, was that al-Husseini was the leader of now the new Palestinian resistance. And as Hitler attained to power in Germany in 1933, he had something in common with al-Husseini. It was anti-Semitism, of course. It was a pronounced distaste for the Jewish people and a desire to eradicate them. You combine this with the idea that there is a global conspiracy of Jews and others against the rest of the world. Al-Husseini believed this. The people on the street in Palestine and in most of the Middle East believed it because they saw with their own eyes what had happened after World War I. When the Ottoman Empire had been destroyed, they did not get their independence as promised. They were not able to decide their own boundaries, their own countries. They were sort of force-fed a map that had been created by T.E. Lawrence and Gertrude Bell, two other archaeologists working for the British. So the whole thing was an absolute and utter mess. And in the midst of this mess and in this chaos, a handful of very charismatic, very powerful leaders emerged, and one of these, of course, was al-Husseini. He found himself to be sympathetic to Hitler's claims, to Hitler's ideas that Germany had been betrayed by, against once again, the Jews, the English, the French, the Russians. This is all very much in line with the way al-Husseini was educated and brought up. He believed in the same things, and he thought that Hitler would make a natural ally and the Nazi Party would make a natural ally. And the rest is history. What happened during World War II was that al-Husseini became an ally of the Nazi Party and of the Third Reich. He was based in Berlin. They gave him a very nice villa in Berlin from which he did broadcast some radio messages across the water into Palestine, telling the people to rise up, telling the people that the Nazis were on their side, repeating all of the slanders from the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, doing all of this to raise consciousness among the Arabs to say that, you know, let's fight on the side of the Germans because they'll help us get rid of the British and the French out of the Middle East. So there are photographs of al-Husseini blessing troops, blessing a division of Muslim fighters, the Hanshar division, the Waffen-SS division, which was a Muslim, largely Muslim division. It was a Bosnian group. These were Caucasian Muslims. This was sort of fit in with the idea of the German Reich, although the Germans kind of had their doubts about the Balkans and their racial purity. They were going to make some exceptions in this case, especially as the Bosnians and the Croatians were trying to prove that they were really Aryans all along, trying to prove some dubious genetic heritage. But at any rate, the idea was they were going to fight against the same enemies. And so you had this bizarre situation where you had Muslim troops being run by imams, religious leaders, who were all swearing oaths to Hitler. And you had photographs, numerous photographs and documentary film footage of Emir al-Husseini walking down, reviewing the troops, you might say blessing the troops, speaking with Hitler, speaking with Himmler. The alliance between this kind of Islamic nationalism, Arab nationalism, and a kind of radical Islamic nationalism and Nazism was concretized during this period of the 1940s in Germany. It became sort of a global movement of Muslims, specific Muslims, not naturally, of course, all Muslims, but specific Muslims, mostly those who had suffered under the colonial powers in the Middle East, an alliance of those people with the Nazis because they had common enemies. They had common enemies in the Jews, common enemies in the other Western powers, the Brits, the French, the Russians, and eventually, of course, the Americans. So this alliance was an unholy alliance of Muslims, certain specific Muslims, Nazis, and fellow travelers against the West, against the degeneracy they saw in the West, against the idea that the West was basically atheist, irreligious, in bed with Masonic groups, in bed with the Jews. And there was really no evidence to the contrary that the average Arab living in the Middle East could see. All he could see was the evidence of his own eyes, which is that there were Brits British troops in Palestine, that the countries had been divided up by the European powers, that they were playing a kind of chess game with the Arab leaders, placing them here, placing them there. And, of course, in the back of all of this is oil and access to the Suez Canal. And so al-Husseini, of course, World War II was lost. Al-Husseini fled. He wound up in various places in the Middle East, but then he was arrested at one point. He escaped, they say dressed as a woman. And then in the end, of all of, once all the dust had settled, he was still the major spokesperson for Arab nationalism and the Arab liberation movements right up into the 1970s.
In the immediate post-war period, jihadism or global jihadism continued to develop as an ideology, and one of the points we touched on in our very first interview, and I'd like to touch on briefly here, are some of the elements of ideological resonance between Nazism and global jihadism, bearing in mind, as we have talked about and as you have emphasized, that the use of jihadis as proxy warriors began in World War I with Germany and then in World War II with the Nazis and Germany, specifically as an anti-colonial stratagem. And we should never lose sight of the foundations, the historical foundations against which this was formed. But looking at some of the points of ideological resonance between the global Islamism or jihadism and Nazism. Let's start with the longing for a simpler, better time.
Well, you know, this is always the issue with groups of this nature. It's, you know, once upon a time. The idea that at some point in the past there was a golden age, and in this golden age their people or their religion or their ethnic group or their nation was on top of the pyramid, you know, was enjoying this a wonderful age in which everything was right with the world, and then things went wrong and now we have to go back to that golden age. That golden age, of course, never really existed. That's sort of a psychological vulnerability, I suppose, but they believe that it did. They believe that things were much better in the days of the Khalifa, of the Caliphate, in terms of the Muslims. In terms of the Germans, it was better before the advent of Christianity in Europe. It was better when Germany was pagan, or all of the Teutonic peoples were pagan. There's this idea that something really went wrong, and it's odd because, of course, the Germans were longing for a pagan golden age, whereas the Muslims were just looking for an Islamic golden age, which wasn't that far in the past. We're talking about the 8th century, perhaps, or 9th century CE, up to about the 15th century. So they were longing for a time that was almost within memory within the last 400 years or so, whereas the Germans were looking for a past that was thousands of years earlier, if it really existed at all. So these two groups had that in common. They also despised what they saw as Western decadence. The founder of the Salafi movement, or some of the other leaders of the Salafis and the Wahhabis, these extremists, when they had visited the United States, would come back and they would be shocked at what they saw as Western American decadence. And to them, decadence meant jazz. It meant women being relatively liberated, women being allowed to go where they wanted to go, dress the way they wanted to dress, women and men mingling freely in society. All of these things were considered decadent. And on the other side of the coin, there was communism. There was the Soviet Union, and they had a specific kind of decadence as well, which was materialism and atheism. So the radical Islamic movements shared a lot in common with Hitler, with the Nazi ideology, which saw, again, the West as decadent, which saw cities as centers of pestilence. The German longing was to go back to the countryside to live a simpler life. The West, especially Western cities, were considered to be hotbeds of Jewish propaganda and Jewish culture and influence, as well as the power of the bankers and of industrialists. All of these were considered to be evils that had to be gotten rid of or avoided at all costs. And this is something that they share together with this Muslim movement, this anti-Western movement. And they were both international movements. Islamic fundamentalism began to rise, it was a pan-Arab movement at first. The idea was that it would be all the Arab peoples who were all basically Muslim, and they were going to rise up against their non-Muslim occupiers and colonizers. And then later it became extended so that it was Muslims all over the world were supposed to be part of this group. They were all united against the common enemy. This was a fantasy, basically, because that was just not going to happen. It hasn't happened yet. There is no such thing as a kind of sentiment which would bring all Muslims together as one group. As we know, the Sunnis and the Shia despise each other and kill each other with reckless abandon. Throw into that mix a lot of the other types of cults, you might say, that we find in the Middle East, Kurdish cults, the Yazidis, or the Alawis in Syria, the Druze in Lebanon, et cetera, you find groups that are not quite Muslim, not quite Christian or Jewish, and yet they're all part of this mosaic of cultures and peoples. But there is this idea promulgated by the people who founded these movements like the Wahhabis and the Salafis that there is a united religion behind all Muslims, that they should all get together and find a common enemy and get rid of this common enemy. What would happen after they had done that? Well, you can see what's happening in the Middle East today. There is complete division, complete bifurcation of any kind of a joint Islamic movement. They despise each other, and they're still killing each other. So it was a fantasy. It's a fantasy that has yet to be realized. But at the same time as this international Islamic movement was forming, the Nazis, who had been defeated in World War II as far as the war was concerned, as far as the Wehrmacht and Germany was concerned, the Nazis themselves did not feel that they had been essentially defeated. They were, as I mentioned before, true believers, and they were going to carry their message around the world. The networks had already been established. There were Nazi party organs and offices and operatives in all over the world, all over Latin America, all over the Middle East, North America, and parts of Asia as well. So we had the networks already there. We had the movement of money, of personnel, of documents, of technology, and all of this taking place. So we had a universal, kind of a global Nazi movement carrying the message of the Reich, the Nazi message around the world, especially at a time when communism was looking and more and more powerful and more of a threat. Nazis were finding common cause with a lot of anti-communists in this country, in the United States, as well as in Europe and other parts of the world, especially, of course, in South America, which is now fighting communist insurgencies everywhere, and in Asia. So you suddenly had a ripe environment for the growth of this, you might say, this virus, a moist, rich environment for the virus to multiply dramatically. And this is what Nazism did, as well as universal kind of a global Islamism did as well. There was the environment that the communists were atheists, they were materialists, they were also in their own way a colonial power. Look what they had taken over in Central Asia, for instance, and even as far as in Siberia, all the way to Vladivostok on the other side of Korea and China. So it appeared as though the Soviet Union was just as colonialist as the West. That it was exporting its own brand of atheism and its kind of quasi-religious ideology and philosophy to the rest of the world. So Muslims in the middle were feeling squeezed between the two superpowers and between these two very strong ideologies, which were well-armed ideologies with nuclear weapons, with vast armies, with navies around the world. And now we have the Arab people, and then by extension the Islamic people, the Muslim people around the world, feeling that they're in the middle of these two movements. And so they would make common cause with people who were feeling the same way. And this was, of course, the Nazi party operatives around the world. So you began to see cooperation taking place between Muslim organizations and Muslim individuals involved in liberation movements. And Nazis. I mean, real Nazis, not just fellow travelers, not just people who shared some ideas in common with Nazis, but people who had been high-ranking Nazis during the war who fled and who are now setting up networks around the world, including those aiding and abetting Arab nationalism and Islamic fundamentalism.
Peter, I'd like to reread a few sentences from your book. We read these a week or two ago, and then go into some more detail about what was going on in the Middle East in the immediate post-war period. On page 113 of The Hitler Legacy, you write, and I quote, "What the Nazis knew was that they could carry on their ideological struggle from anywhere on earth, and they did. The war was not over for them. They had simply moved the theater of operations to the Middle East, the Americas, Central Asia, and to South and Southeast Asia. And they did all of that with the assistance from the very governments that had defeated them. This would be absurd if it weren't true." In the Middle East, of course, with the Cold War going on and after Colonel Nasser came to power in Egypt, there was great concern in the West about Soviet influence in the Middle East and the Arab countries. And so the Galen organization that we spoke about and Alan Dulles decamped, a fellow we'll talk about more later in this talk, a fellow named Otto Skorzeny, to the Middle East, where he basically presided over the incorporation of some truly heinous war criminals into the espionage and technical development services of some of the Arab countries. Develop some of those names for us, and also note that some of these fellows also became Muslims themselves. They converted.
Yes, it's one of the things that surprised even me as I began to research this a few years ago, was the fact that we kept coming across, or I kept coming across, Nazis, some of whom were quite well known at the time, who had actually converted to Islam and even adopted Muslim names and lived in Muslim countries. This was something that, again, would be, you know, rather astonishing if it wasn't true. It's just, it's unbelievable. I'll take as an example, I think Johann von Leers is a very good example. Johann von Leers was an SS officer. He worked for Goebbels in the propaganda ministry. He was sort of a right-hand man of Joseph Goebbels, and he wound up fleeing first to Argentina, where he ran a Nazi newspaper called Der Weg, The Way. And he was involved with a lot of the American quote-unquote neo-Nazi movements. As you know, I don't like the term neo-Nazi. I think it's it devalues, in a sense, what's really going on, or it tried to trivialize the fact that, you know, the Nazi movement still exists the way it did during in the 1930s. But let's call it neo-Nazi for sake of lack of a better term. He was involved with those groups. I knew some of the people in North America that von Leers was involved with. I didn't know at the time, of course. I didn't even know the name von Leers. But at the time, he was involved with people like James Madole of the National Renaissance Party. Someone that I knew quite well, that I had been to his apartment in Manhattan. I had been involved with him in Pennsylvania in interviewing Roy Frankhauser, who was a Ku Klux Klan organizer, a very famous guy in FBI files. This was a really energetic individual who was violently anti-Semite, or I should say anti-Jewish. We could make have a half an hour discussion as to what constitutes a Semite, since Arabs essentially are also Semitic. Let's leave that discussion aside and use the term anti-Semite the way we understand it, which means anti-Jewish. Von Leers was, of course, violently anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. He ran his newspaper out of Peron's Argentina for a number of years. He published articles in that newspaper by American Nazis, as well as by European Nazis and Latin American Nazis. And eventually von Leers left Argentina and took a position in Nasser's government in Egypt, running anti-Israel propaganda. And he became a Muslim, and he changed his name to Omar Amin. There was the Hitler youth leader, Karl Luder, who moved to Egypt. I think it was in 63. There was so many of them. There was a man from the SS called Seipel, who became involved in Egypt with the security service. There were a lot of Nazis involved in training the troops and training commandos, especially training secret police in Egypt under Nasser's regime. And, of course, probably the most important, most famous aspect of this move of Nazis to Egypt were the scientists who were developing weapons of mass destruction. They were developing rockets based on their old technologies, the V-1 and V-2 designs and other designs, in order to develop the missiles that would strike into the heart of Israel. And this was taking place in the late 1950s, early 1960s. So you had a Nazi consortium of technicians and scientists, engineers, who were had exported their technology. We talked about the Red House report, I think, at the last discussion, the Maison Rouge declaration by the SS that they had to move their technology overseas, and in this case they were successful in doing that to Egypt. And Argentina was the other location where they were successfully moving technology. We had aerospace engineers moving to Argentina and developing jet aircraft for Perón, for instance, and looking for alternate energy sources as well. So we have this major movement of Nazis who, as you mentioned earlier, they just moved their theater of operations. They were continuing the fight against the enemies of Germany, against the enemies of the Aryan people. They were continuing the fight from Egypt, among other places, Syria as well, Libya. The very famous SS wanted war criminal, probably the most wanted war criminal after Eichmann and Mengele, was Alois Brunner. Brunner wound up in Syria for a very, very long time. In fact, we're not even quite sure he died. Of course, he must have died by now, but he changed his name to Ali Mohammed and moved to Damascus and became an advisor to the Syrian government there. So you had Germans, specifically Nazis, who found themselves in positions of importance and prominence in many of the Middle Eastern capitals, with the exception, of course, of Israel. And they were all advising Arab leaders on how to deal with the quote-unquote Jewish question or quote-unquote Jewish problem, as well as dealing with the United States and dealing with Russia, because Nasser was between a rock and a hard place. Alan Dulles wanted to support Nasser as much as possible against the Soviet Union to make sure that Nasser stayed anti-communist as much as possible, pro-American. So Dulles was one of those who urged Nasser to accept the German scientists and to accept help from people like Otto Skorzeny, who was an arms dealer, among other things, to accept Skorzeny's help in the Middle East and in Egypt. Dulles didn't particularly care one way or the other about the fate of Israel. What he really was concerned about was the communist threat, and he figured that if he supported Nasser with Nazis or whatever else that Nasser wanted, that was fine with him. As it turned out, Nasser started a kind of flirtation with the Soviets, and that gave everybody a lot of problems, especially the Nazis who were there in Egypt, and that became problematic for them as well. But for a number of years, it was the welcome mat was open, was out welcoming Nazi scientists, Nazi technicians, people who were training in interrogation techniques, torture techniques, and that sort of thing in Egypt, and eventually wound up training the man who would later become head of the PLO, Yasser Arafat, would be trained by Nazi trainers. I personally at one point visited the offices of the Palestine Liberation Organization in New York City. They had observer status at the United Nations. And I visited them, must have been about 1969, 1970, something like that. And at that time, they had a very small office with a very thick steel door. And when I knocked on the door, I was greeted by a receptionist who was German, a German woman. There were Germans in and out of that place all the time. And I dealt with, of course, with the head of the delegation there at that time was Dr. Izzat Tanous. And then later on, he was replaced by a man called Sadat Hassan. And they had excellent relationships with Syria, with Egypt, even though these were Palestinians, and, of course, with many Germans of dubious background and dubious character. And, as I said, these people would also be coming in and out of the offices there in New York City. So there was this idea that the Palestinian movement also had to find common cause with the Nazis, just like al-Husseini had done. And when I'm visiting the PLO offices to find out what's going on there, al-Husseini was still very much alive and was still very much behind the scenes of the PLO and all of the internecine conflicts that were taking place between the PLO and between the PLO and the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was run by a Christian at that time, Dr. George Navas. So there were a lot of different characters, a lot of different agendas taking place, but the unifying ideology, this kind of pro-Nazi ideology, was there. These were, you know, the good, quote-unquote, white people, the ones who were on our side against the colonial powers, against the Americans, against the Russians, and, of course, against Israel. So this went on, as I say, my first visits to the PLO were back in 1969, 1970. And then jump forward almost 40 years, and in 2007, I was visiting with the head of Jamaah Islamiyah in Indonesia, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate, visiting the headquarters there of a man who was responsible, who had instigated the Bali bombings of 2002. And he expressed the same ideology, identical to that you might have heard in Germany in the 1930s, a worldwide Jewish conspiracy against the West, the Muslims, of the West against the Muslims, on and on. All of these things, all of these pat phrases that he had learned 50 years before and still believed them, believing that the protocols were genuine, was not a hoax document, believing that there was a Jewish conspiracy to control the world, believing that the Prime Minister of Singapore, the Prime Minister of Australia, and the American President were all in it together, et cetera, et cetera. So you're hearing exactly the same ideology. It hasn't changed a beat. It hasn't changed. It's not the words and not the music in all of these years, all of these decades since the end of the war. And it shows the reach and the extent of this ideology, even into a city in the middle of Indonesia, in Java. It doesn't matter. You might as well have been in Berlin in 1936.
In a future interview, we will talk about how that really is not as surprising as it might seem, Peter. One of the personages, one of the SS Nazi veterans who worked in the Middle East, also in many ways embodies a point that I would like you to develop. You note on page 165 that the term neo-Nazi, which you've already indicated you view with something of a jaundiced eye, at least up to a point, that you really can't call the post-war Nazi institutions neo-Nazi because they sprang full-blown from people whose pedigrees in the SS, the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, and the Gestapo are very, very profound indeed. If you would develop, Raymer, and how the term neo-Nazi really is not valid in light of the activities of people like Raymer, Otto Skorzeny, Hans Ulrich Budel, and others.
Certainly. I have a real problem with the term neo-Nazi. I think it's used to, it's very false, it's misleading. There's an idea that there was a break somehow between Nazism and neo-Nazism. We use the term neo-pagan these days to refer to people who are trying to go back to some kind of a pagan in illo tempora, you know, some sort of pagan past, which probably is non-existent as well, but they're trying to recreate this idea. And when we say neo-Nazi, it kind of makes it appear there's a bunch of kids out there who are sort of wearing swastika armbands and pretending to be Nazis. That is very, very far from the truth. There's nothing neo about Nazism in this day and age because it's within recent memory. And the people who have been running the Nazi underground, the networks after the war, were and are and remain Nazis. I mean, they were Nazis during the Third Reich. Just because the war was over, they didn't suddenly turn from Nazi to neo-Nazi. They were still Nazis. And the person that you reference just now was Otto Raymer. Otto Raymer is a perfect example of this type of person. Otto Raymer was an SS officer. He was the person involved. He was a general. And during Operation Valkyrie, which was the attempted assassination plot against Hitler, Raymer pretended to be involved with the plot on the side of the plot organizers, and once the plot was underway, he was the person who had them all arrested and executed. So Otto Raymer was a total Nazi, very devoted to Hitler, and to the ideals of the Third Reich. He was denazified, sort of, at the end of the war. He then started to try to support a Reich-oriented, a Nazi-oriented political party in Austria, where he was from. And that failed. That was exposed. But Raymer never really lost any chance to promote Nazism around the world. Raymer was very involved in the movements in Latin America. He was very involved in the movements in North Africa. He was instrumental, in some cases, in running guns and running money into the Middle East. He was very involved with Adolf Eichmann, as an example. He was involved with Alois Brunner, who we've already mentioned, in Syria. He was very involved with Skorzeny and Hans-Ulrich Rudel. All of these, you know, leading lights of Odessa, of the Nazi underground, include Otto Raymer, to the extent that Otto Raymer was also invited to speak in the United States on more than one occasion. And one particular occasion, he was invited to speak to the Liberty Lobby at a meeting at which our old friend Pat Buchanan was in attendance.
By the way, Pat Buchanan was Ronald Reagan's White House communications director.
Absolutely. And an ideologue in his own right. But yes, he was very much involved in the White House. He is a person with access straight to the top, to the Oval Office at that time. And here he is attending meetings by one of the most famous SS generals ever, which is Otto Raymer. Raymer also was involved with the American Nazi movements very, very much. He was through people like Hans-Ulrich Rudel and Skorzeny. He was in contact constantly with Nazi movements in the United States, in Canada, and in Latin America. Raymer was a major fixture. He was an ideologue. He was a general. He had the charisma of a person who had known Hitler personally, who had defeated the assassination plot against Hitler, rounded up the conspirators, had them executed. This is a person that we would normally consider to be a heinous individual, a person that we would not want to have anything to do with. And yet there were many political organizations in the United States and elsewhere around the world who welcomed Raymer as a speaker, welcomed Raymer's support, and looked up to him as somebody who was a valiant fighter against communism and against decadence, you know, the ideas of Western decadence, against liberalism, which is usually associated in the minds of some people with decadence. So any kind of liberal progressive ideas were considered decadent, Jewish ideals. Even human rights considered to be a figment of the liberal imagination or the Jewish imagination. Raymer was against all of that. He was very much in favor of a strong military presence to combat communism anywhere around the world, and that went down very well with a lot of people in the United States. So we're talking about a person who was a facilitator. Not only was he a charismatic individual who would show up and talk enthusiastically to his audiences no matter where in the world, but he was also very much a facilitator where the transfer of money and guns was concerned. He was a person who knew who you could trust and who you could not trust. He was a person in the middle of all of that, just as thick as Skorzeny and Rudel. Here was someone who had all of the credentials that you needed. Skorzeny was a famous commando. Rudel was a famous pilot of the Luftwaffe. But Raymer was an SS general, and here was someone who had defeated the people who were trying to overthrow the Reich in 1944. So you put all these guys together, and you have got the core of a new Nazi movement, which is exactly how they saw themselves. And the best way to be a Nazi movement in the 1950s and in the 1960s was to support anti-Western liberation movements around the world, and that meant particularly those in North Africa and the Middle East.
At the same time, these same really underground Reich operatives were using their office with Western intelligence agencies, such as the CIA through the Galen Organization, to perpetuate this post-war underground Reich. They were able to dovetail their perpetuation of Nazism with their intelligence work. In our second interview, Peter, you recounted for us your hair-raising visit to Colonia Dignidad, and I think in many ways that institution is something of the embodiment of this Janus-faced entity, which at one level is working for Western intelligence and elements of that were involved with Operation Condor. And then the other face is that of a post-war Reich, where the Nazi institutions are not neo at all, but have been midwived directly by, you know, heinous SS and SD veterans. If you tell us about recount Colonia Dignidad, and in particular its role as a Nazi outpost and a locus for Operation Condor, in which some elements of Western intelligence are come into the mix.
Well, yes, this was probably for me, just as you say, it was the place that really embodied exactly everything that we're talking about, because it brought it all together in one particular space, and it coalesced all of this for me back in 79 when I was there, and I began to realize the extent of their reach, which only became emphasized in later years and later decades as more and more information came out. But we're talking about a remote mountain estate in Chile that was begun around 1962 or so. A Luftwaffe medical officer from World War II was also a Baptist minister, a quote-unquote Baptist minister. It's kind of hard to determine exactly his origins as far as the Baptist Church is concerned. But anyway, he had his own religious movement, his own religious following. But he had been accused as a child molester and a pedophile in Germany, and he escaped. But he escaped with many followers, many of his people from Germany. They went to Chile, which had always been very congenial to Germans in general. There's a large German population there. There are parts of Chile in which all the towns are German, the newspapers are German, street signs are in German. And so they feel very much at home there. And, of course, the Andes Mountains and some parts of it look a lot like Bavaria. So this man, his name is Paul Schaefer, went and created a mountaintop estate with funds from somewhere. As it turned out, many of his followers were getting some kind of compensation from the German government. They signed over their checks to him. They signed over their money to him. But there was funding from other places. We can get into that. And he set up this estate, very remote, very difficult to get to, up a dirt road in those days when I was there. Right up into the mountains, heavily fortified, heavily guarded, barbed wire fencing and that sort of thing. A lot of buildings, a lot of construction had taken place there. It was pretty much self-sufficient in many ways. And that was begun in the 1960s. By 1970, Chile had a socialist president, a democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. As we know now from the White House Oval Office tapes, Nixon and Kissinger had determined that Allende would not remain in power very long. They would do what they had to do to get rid of Allende. Kissinger famously said that Chile was a dagger pointed at the heart of America because they had a socialist president. And it's true. Allende was a socialist. He was a friend of Fidel Castro on the one hand, of Gabriel Garcia Marquez on the other. He was an intellectual. He was a cultured man. He had been a violent anti-Nazi in Chile during World War II. There's a lot of documentation on Allende's position on being an anti-Nazi, which did not endear him to the generals, to the army in Chile, which idolized Nazi Germany. So Allende in 1970 is president, and in 1973, on September 11th, the country is overthrown. Allende dies in the La Moneda, which is the presidential palace. Very famous, iconic photographs of him wearing a military helmet and holding a machine gun, trying to defend the presidential palace from the attacks of the generals. The generals take over. Augusto Pinochet, who had been trained in the United States, had been trained at the famous academy where military leaders all over the world are trained. He had become president. He had the total backing of the United States government, and the rest, as they say, is history. They had to round up the people who were pro-Allende supporters, people who were against the generals and the regime, people who were suspected of being socialists, of being communists, of being leftists. They were arrested, and they were taken to the National Stadium in Santiago, the capital of Chile, where they were executed, including two Americans. believed to be leftists, Charles Horman being the famous case, which they made a movie with Sissy Spacek and Jack Lemmon, a Costa Gavras film. And then there was Colonia Dignidad. And Colonia Dignidad was a special case. Because Schaefer had been a Luftwaffe medic, he developed very close ties to the Chilean military, particularly the Air Force, but also to the Army. When Pinochet took over, the entire country was put under martial law. And that meant that the police were made part of the Army as well. The carabineros were part of the military apparatus. The entire state, the entire country of Chile had been militarized. Colonia Dignidad became a center for training the operatives of DINA, which in those days was the Chilean secret police. The torture and interrogation techniques that the Chilean officers developed had been honed at Colonia Dignidad. The training was taking place there. And the torture chambers had been designed by an American, Nazi, Michael Vernon Townley, who was part of the Patria Libertad movement, which was a kind of a Nazi organization in Chile run by a guy called Franz Pfeiffer. There were a lot of other Nazi organizations in Chile going back since the 1930s. They were still quite active in one form or another. And the colony torture interrogation was part of the menu of training that was taking place there. And the colony also served as a safe house, as a sanctuary for Nazi war criminals. If you look at the map of Chile and look specifically for Colonia Dignidad, which is outside of a town called Parral up in the mountains, you'll see that it's on the border between Chile and Argentina. That's a very strategic location because it meant that if they saw trucks, police coming up the dirt road towards the colony, they could take off essentially out the back door and wind up in Argentina. And that's exactly what happened when finally the Pinochet regime did fall. And, a democratically elected president was put in power. They raided the colony, and Paul Schaefer, the leader, escaped into Argentina, where he was eventually found. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. During the 1970s, 1980s, there was something called Operation Condor. And Operation Condor was a kind of an ad hoc assassination organization, mostly involving the Southern Cone countries in Latin America. It was designed to ferret out leftists, communists, socialists, and to target them for assassination. There were assassination attempts in Europe by the operatives of Operation Condor. There was a very successful assassination in Washington, D.C. that was carried out under the auspices of Condor. And the person who organized that assassination was the same man, Michael Vernon Townley, who had set up the torture and interrogation cells at Colonia Dignidad. He hired a number of anti-Castro Cubans, shades of Watergate, and conducted this, organized this assassination attempt against a man called Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffat, his assistant. He blew up their car pretty much right outside the Chilean embassy so the Chileans could see that he had been successful. Letelier was murdered. Ronnie Moffat was murdered. It took a couple of years, but they found out who did it. They found Michael Townley. They had him arrested. He's now in witness protection. He's in prison, but he's in witness protection, being moved from one prison to the other. And he's still being debriefed as to what's going on with underground Nazi movements, underground anti-communist movements in Latin America, what groups he was involved with, assassination attempts, bombings in Europe against suspected leftists and all the rest of it. This is all taking place out of Colonia Dignidad. The connection between the colony and the Pinochet regime was very, very tight. Often Pinochet would borrow the white Mercedes that was used by the colony's leader, by Paul Schaefer. They were friendly that way. They hung out together. They would go to the same clubs in Santiago. That sort of thing was part of what made them very strong. They were ideologically pure. They were completely pro-Pinochet. Pinochet was completely pro-Nazi. Anyone who had been to Chile in those days would have seen how the troops marched, which was goose-stepping. They wore Wehrmacht-style helmets. The officers wore a dagger, like the SS. I mean, there was a complete emulation of this Nazi ideal that was taking place in that country. It was the center not only for Operation Condor. We know it was also really the telephone exchange for Operation Condor, oddly enough. There was an elaborate communication system at the colony, including antennas, to act as the intermediary between all the remote locations of the underground, of the Nazi underground. We know, for instance, that Mengele once went there. We know that Hans Ulrich Rudel went there. We know that Skorzeny visited the colony. All of this is documented. All of this is known now. This colony was at the center, the epicenter of the Nazi underground in South America. I mean, what better place? They had their own estate on top of a mountain, which was virtually inaccessible. I know because I tried to go back about a couple of years later with the film crew. We had looked at maps and we had tried to find out ways we could get to the colony without being seen, and that turned out to be impossible. There was basically no way to approach the colony secretly. It was too well guarded. There was a river on one side, the mountains on the other, only one access road. You would have needed a complete commando operation to attack the place unseen and you know, do a surprise attack. So that plan got scrapped. But it's it was a place where the ideology of the Reich lived and breathed. It was racially pure, quote-unquote. Certain select children from the local villages were basically kidnapped, kept there for the pleasure of Paul Schaefer, who was a pedophile, who was one of the many of the charges listed against him was that of pedophilia and child abuse. And these children were no longer allowed to speak Spanish. They had to speak German. Interviews with these children can be seen. And it's a heartbreaking kind of a thing to realize that you're looking at a boy who was brought up in Chile, probably in Parral, in one of the small towns around the colony. And he's being asked questions in German. He's responding in German. He's actually forgotten how to speak Spanish. This is what was going on there, this kind of brainwashing, this kind of mind control situation. They developed poisons there. There's photographs now and documentation showing that they were stockpiling sarin gas in large quantities. We don't know who the intended targets might have been. This was an ongoing thing. This was a real, verifiable threat. It was a threat to peace in the region. It was a threat to the world because we don't know what the end game was for these people. We know they conducted terrorist operations in Europe. We know they conducted assassinations in Europe and in the United States and in other parts of Latin America. So their reach was global. And they were developing global weaponry, you know, and this was only one place that we know of, only one location that became famous. Since then, we've uncovered underground bunkers in different parts of Europe that we didn't know existed until a few months ago. The reach of this operation is extensive, and we ignore it at our peril.
Peter, we are almost out of time, and in our next talk, I'd like to continue with a discussion of some of the institutions on the post-war underground Reich landscape. However, we're almost out of time. Again, people ask me, well, I believe what you're saying, but I don't know what to do about it. Something they can do about it, and I don't get any financial compensation for this, but they can obtain and read your book and tell people about it. Tell them where they can obtain The Hitler Legacy.
Certainly. You can go to the usual suspects. Amazon.com, of course, has it. Barnes & Noble has it. You can also log on to my website, peterlavenda.com, for more information, updates as they become available. There's links to other sites as well from there. So it's readily available. It's not difficult to find.
All righty. We have been speaking with Peter Lavenda, and this concludes For the Record program number 841. Interview number 4 with Peter Lavenda about the Hitler legacy, being recorded on March 29th of the year 2015. For Peter Lavenda, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.